This is Radio MD COVID-19 Daily, your source for COVID-19 news from the front lines of healthcare. I'm Caitlin White. Happy Monday. It's March 30th. I hope your weekend was as relaxed and restorative as it can be during this time. President Trump has extended the guidelines for social distancing. Despite claiming America would be up and running by Easter, Trump is now asking all Americans to avoid non-essential travel or groups larger than 10 until April 30th. While hiking or just being outside may seem like the only thing that's left to do in this age of quarantine, but even some popular trails and national parks are asking visitors to stay home. Radio MD's Bill Klaproth has more.
As many of us are seeing malls and restaurants and local stores closing, add a few more things to the list as the National Park Service has now closed Arches and Canyonlands National Parks in Utah until further notice. Southeast Utah Health Department Health Officer Braden Bradford says visitors not only risk transmitting or becoming infected with the coronavirus, but increase the strain on local communities' limited health care facilities if they injure themselves or need other medical attention. And parks elsewhere, including Yellowstone and the Great Smoky Mountains, have closed at the request of local managers. And hikers are now being asked to stay away from the famed Appalachian Trail, which covers 14 states from Georgia to Maine. Sandra Mara, president and CEO of the Appalachian Trail Conservatory, in a blog post writes, "Please stay away from the Appalachian Trail, or AT. Whether your hike is for a couple of hours or a couple of days, staying away from the trail minimizes the spread or contraction of COVID-19, adding the ATC does not want to do too little, too late. We cannot close the trail. We cannot physically bar access to trailheads or connecting trails. But what we can do, however, is urge everyone to please stay away from the Appalachian Trail until further notice." For Radio MD News, I'm Bill Klaproth.
As Americans stockpile disinfectant wipes, hand sanitizer, and soap, how long does COVID-19 really last on different surfaces? With that information, we go to Radio MD's Scott Webb.
Thanks, Caitlin. We've known for years that our shoes are a breeding ground for germs, fungi, and viruses, but it's being reported now that COVID-19 could survive for up to 5 days on shoes, depending on the materials. Experts are saying that it's best to leave our shoes outside whenever possible. The virus can survive for days on many other surfaces, including doorknobs and paper for up to 5 days, milk containers for 2 to 3 days, and aluminum for 2 to 8 hours. COVID-19 has not been found in water supplies to date. Reporting for Radio MD News, I'm Scott Webb.
With COVID-19 spreading so quickly all across the globe, one thing people are wondering is, how can I get tested? Ray Biotech is a leading life sciences company that has developed a rapid antibody test using blood from a finger prick to test for SARS-CoV-2. Results are available within just 10 minutes. Dr. Jared Wilson joined Dr. Suzanne Bennett on her podcast, Wellness for Life, to explain how the test works, its accuracy, and where this testing methodology is with the FDA.
Let's first talk about the different tests you have, and then let's go into the lateral flow.
Sure. So per the CDC guidelines, we did develop the real-time PCR-based assay, but as a very high-complexity-based molecular assay, it requires a high-complexity lab to perform. So that limits not only testing, but people that can test. And so during that same time, we got lucky with some positive samples and went ahead and tried to develop a lateral flow serology test looking for IgG, IgM antibodies to the target proteins of coronavirus, specifically the N protein. And so in that case, we're looking for, in your serum or your whole blood sample, like a finger prick, like you were mentioning, just a quick 10-minute test. If you've got antibodies to it, it'll bind up the protein and give a nice signal at the test line. To put it into layman's terms, you're likely used to like the pregnancy test for the P-strip. So imagine that, but with blood. And you basically get 10 minutes, a positive or a negative, and then you can go from there.
Let's go ahead then. A lot of people that are listening may not understand what IgG, IgM means and what exactly the test is showing. So let's go into the two different types of antibodies that you're looking for in your test. Right now, your tests actually have two different kits for the IgM and IgG. And I was very fortunate to be able to do it on myself today. And with flying colors, they did show up, they were negative, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to be cautious and still protect myself. It just means that right now, as of, you know, today, it shows that my immunoglobulins and my immune responses were negative. So can we talk about then the two different, you know, immunoglobulins, and tell us about the timing, please, the timing and why this is so important.
Sure. So our timing is a bit of a guess because we're waiting on some real official, you know, hard studies done on the serology kinetics. But loosely speaking, the immune response's first response with antibodies is with an isotype called immunoglobulin M, IgM, pentamer of antibodies kind of linked together. It is really good at neutralizing the virus and targeting it for getting eaten by macrophages and other things. So it's really good as a first responder. After the IgM comes up and the immune system fully kicks in, class switching happens, whereby the immune system mutates that cell that's producing the IgM antibodies into different isotypes. And one of them that we're looking for here is IgG, so immunoglobulin G. Those antibodies are even more specific and have other fun traits. So they're single antibodies that can, you know, they can cross the placental barrier. They can go throughout the body. They're not as big as the IgM complex. So in general, you know, IgM comes up first, and then as the body takes over with IgG, the IgM wanes and usually goes away. It probably stays to some degree. But if you have an IgM response, you're likely infected with something. So in this case, obviously SARS, if you're showing up as a positive. The IgG, on the other hand, takes, say, 2 weeks. Sometimes it can come up even earlier. It just really depends. It's highly person-to-person variable. You know, IgM response maybe as early as 3 days. We could probably pick it up maybe in the five-day window. We're not really sure. Again, we're kind of doing some guesswork based on some old SARS data on when it would be positive. And then from that 5 to 14-day window, your body would really start to transition away from IgM to a better IgG response. So if you've been exposed, you could possibly still register as a positive, you know, for some extended period until the titer just became too low. But if you got reinfected, you could come up IgM and IgG positive initially. So that's a general rough guess on the kinetics for now, that at least as far as we understand it.
Great. So just to be clear, you know, if anyone does a test, you want to know whether or not the person, you don't want to be taking the test right after you went to your local food market and you think that you got exposed. This takes time. Your body takes time to make these immunoglobulins, IgM. So doing the test in the first 2 days, I would say it's safe to say it's better to wait like 3-4 days. And for the IgM, the peak might be up to about 7 to 14 days. That's what I'm hearing. And then as the IgM starts to go down after about 14 days, maybe at about 7-day mark, you might start to see IgGs, and it starts to climb up on the peak, maybe about 28, which is 4 weeks, about 28 days. But so you can actually have both IgM and IgG positive at one time in that little sweet spot window. Is that correct?
That's correct. So yeah, the IgG response is overtakes the IgM in terms of titer, the amount of antibody present per unit of volume, quite substantially. Because again, IgM is your first responder. You want to kind of get it out pretty quickly because it's only so good. Whereas IgG is much better. It's smaller, has much more, you know, fun activity levels.
Right. Let's be clear also, anyone who is immunosuppressed or on immunosuppressants actually may not have a good pop on these tests. Is that correct? Because I believe that that's something you need to be careful with. And the number one test that is going to definitely give you a positive in accuracy is a PCR test.
Sure. Yeah, the PCR is the tried and true. That one's looking specifically for viral RNA, so the presence of the virus, usually in a nasal swab or some sort of throat swab. So that is, you know, the gold standard against, like, you have the virus, right? And you're detecting the virus, you obviously have the virus. Problem with that is it's just as limited. There's some just sheer bottlenecks involved with getting that testing done. It takes longer. It's procedurally longer. And then you've got to deal with everyone making it. As it relates to our IgM test, yeah, it's just because you went to the grocery store today doesn't mean in 3 days you're going to be positive. It definitely, if you're immune suppressed, you know, people on various inhibitors certainly will have a dulled response or even a muted response and won't respond very well at IgM at all. It'll mostly like class switch internally. It may not even be detectable. And so this is where some of the serology tests are limiting. It's not a perfect assay, but it's, you know, it's much more high throughput with pretty good sensitivity and specificity characteristics. I mean, it's not 99.9% like the real-time assay can get to, you know, but at 90%, you know, trying to screen a whole lot of people. 90% may be good enough in an en masse screening.
Hear this full interview and many more with Dr. Suzanne on her podcast, Wellness for Life, found on all podcast platforms. If this pandemic could be defined by one phrase, I would think flattening the curve would be it. This is why we're seeing lockdowns, shelter-in-place orders, and other terms for staying inside. To discuss this term a little bit more, we're joined by Dr. Lee Vinoker, a board-certified emergency physician and spokesperson for the American College of Emergency Physicians. Give us a brief rundown about flattening the curve. What exactly is it that we should be trying to do?
So basically, when a new virus that nobody has immunity, it's an, sort of an epidemiologic term and study. And when a new virus circulates, like in the human population, and nobody has any immunity to it, there's a very steep rise in the effectiveness of it. Mm-hmm. So it spreads through the population very quickly because nobody has immunity. And if you compare it to the flu, I believe the numbers are even greater. So the flu, basically, I think it's 1.3 people can be infected by a infected person. And truthfully, I believe when you talk about COVID-19, if you looked at how many people can be infected by an infected person called the R-naught or R-zero, it's 2.5. So it spreads more rapidly. And by practicing physical distancing, you know, if all those people in the population rushed into our healthcare system at once, it would overwhelm the healthcare system. And I think we started the social distancing now, but places like New York, where there's high population density, where people use public transportation and are close together and live close together, are all apartment buildings and such, you can see how, you know, even though they've enacted these measures, how it first started spreading very rapidly, and a lot of the healthcare systems there are getting overwhelmed now. So it's very important what people can do for their part is by staying home, staying away from other people, and isolating themselves. You kind of spread out the virus spread. And it might be present a little bit longer time, but not such a peak of people coming into the healthcare system. So that's what we mean by flattening the curve. You're trying not to overwhelm the system with a large amount of people coming in. And it exists, but it spreads not quite as fast, right, than if you're in a crowded area where you're just going about your business and you're in contact with so many different people. So it stops the spread so fast and stops people all at once kind of coming in and overwhelming the system.
So I know we're supposed to stay at home, but can you talk about, I mean, there's things we have to do, right? Like we have to get groceries once a week. There are some things we do have to go outside for. How does that work with, you know, flattening the curve?
Well, it's still, you know, you're not going out and going about your business and seeing people at work all the time. And you know, during cold and flu season, we all are kind of always passing on germs. When you're going through your regular business, say, for example, in a city like New York, you're pressing elevator buttons, you're touching lots of door handles, all those kinds of things. So by staying home as much as possible, you're not out exposed to a lot of people. But the things that you do have to do, what's interesting, I spoke with a friend who lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I say kudos to Trader Joe's there because she said she had to go shopping and Trader Joe's had marked out. She saw a line of people. There were less than 10. So basically, they had marked out 6 feet spacing between 10 people. Everyone else was asked to stay in their car. And then they allowed maybe 20 people in the store at once to, you know, stay away from each other. And when one person came out, they let the next person in. And when the next person came in, another person from the car came to the end of the line. And it was, she said it was very civil and people were happy to wait. And that's some good practicing of, they call it social distancing, but it's really physical distancing.
With different information coming from, you know, states and then the federal government, how do you combat this confusion?
Yeah, it's difficult. And most of my physician colleagues, whether they're ER colleagues or other physicians, really feel like this type of messaging should definitely be left to the public health officials and the physicians that are, you know, running our public health systems. It really shouldn't be the politicians talking about when it's safe to go back to business as usual, because I think that potentially that, you know, could be irresponsible. We have to see what's happening in the health system. And as we said, if we flatten the curve, the chances of the virus kind of still being in the general population, but maybe not everybody all at once getting sick, there's that potential, and opening up business as usual could just sharpen the curve again and get exposure. I mean, there's so many things we don't know. We hope that in the summertime this virus seems to, you know, hang in the air longer in cold, drier weather versus summer humidity, but there's just so many unknowns that we don't really know about it. So I think we really need a kind of wait and see approach to it and see how people are doing and how our healthcare system is handling it all.
We'll be checking in more with Dr. Vanocur as our podcast continues, so subscribe to hear more updates from her. And if you're looking for some good news, John Krasinski is bringing you just that. The actor's series, Some Good News, can be found on YouTube, talking about good stuff happening during the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll have a link to that in our show notes. This has been Radio MD COVID-19 Daily. If you want to reach out to our team with questions or comments, shoot us an email at covid19daily@radiomd.com. That's covid19daily@radiomd.com. We'll be back tomorrow afternoon with more updates wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Caitlin White. Stay safe and stay sanitized.